1 Corinthians chapter 7. Here shortly it's going to feel like we're walking into labor and delivery at a hospital. Because before, if we can make it as far as I hope, there'll be 12 different children that'll be born of Jacob before the hour is over. But I want to really take a moment to look at marriage in terms of relationship between a husband and a wife. Because once we get back to the Old Testament, we're going to see some things that are drastically different under the Old Covenant and even before under the times of the patriarchs in the book of Genesis. So I want to make sure that we kind of lay down the foundation and then kind of move backwards. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, before we look at verse 1, I want to tell you that there was a group kind of along the lines of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Herodians in the first century called the Essenes. And Essene literally meant pious or humble or modest. And they were a people who thought that any kind of intimacy was sinful. So you can imagine what happens to a group like that. They die off eventually. So as part of that, you can understand sometimes these kinds of thinking go around in the neighborhoods and in the places where people are, and it gives rise to some questions. And that may very well be where this comes from. Maybe not, but you could easily understand this. So 1 Corinthians chapter 7, look at verse 1. It says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." Now, the saints in Corinth wrote some questions to Paul, and in doing that, now he's coming through and he's going to answer some of these questions. He's already answered a few of them already in 1 Corinthians. But you can understand they're saying in some way they asked a question that posed this answer, but it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And this is not the idea of hugging a woman or shaking her hand. This is something far more intimate. And so you can imagine the people in Corinth, and especially with all the idolatry in Corinth, of saying, is this really what we should aim to do, to not even have a mate, to refrain from any kind of intimacy situation? But notice verse 2. He says, "But because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband." Now, notice where this is coming out of. "But because of sexual immoralities." He says, there are some desires within men and women. He says, and there needs to be a holy, righteous place for them to be carried out. And so here's Paul addressing them and saying, because of immoralities, he says, each man is to have his own wife and each woman is to have her own husband. And you see this idea of one woman, one man married to each other for life. And to go, and here's a holy place where these desires can be carried out. Now, look at verse 3. "The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does." Now, what you see this picture of, this is kind of one of those unique moments in the New Testament. Typically, we think about the principles in Ephesians 5 about the wife is to be submissive to her husband. The husband's supposed to love his wife. But I want you to notice in this area of the marriage, do you notice there's not a situation in terms of a hierarchy of things? He says, you know what? This is where there's a plateau about both being loving toward each other, to, in other words, not to deprive each other of this part of the relationship, because immoralities are hanging around. There'll be opportunities to go in a wrong direction. And so he carries these things out here in this way to say, these are the fulfillment of what God desires. He's the one who began marriage in the garden. Remember, marriage goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Before man ever sinned, I mean, marriage is really about the last thing in terms of purity that we have from the Garden of Eden. And I know that the tree of life is also there, so I'm not negating that. But going look at what's here, and it was there on purpose, just like it has a purpose now. But this idea of one husband, one wife, being together for life. Now, you see, this is what the principles are under the new covenant. And now we're going to go back to the old covenant, and you're going to see something quite a bit different. And I think you'll understand why. Look back at Exodus chapter 21. Exodus chapter 21. Now here we are under talking about the old covenant. Exodus chapter 21. And I want you to look down at verses 9, 10, and 11. And you'll see that there's even instruction about what if you do have more than one wife? Can you do things any old way you please? Well, let's take a look. Exodus chapter 21, verse 9. If he, talking about a father, designates her, about a female slave, for his own son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. It says she's going to be treated just like a daughter would be treated, not so much like a slave. Verse 10. If he takes to himself another man, so what if this son also takes on another woman, another wife? It says if he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. So you couldn't say, all right, I'm going to marry another wife, and I'm going to treat her superior to how I treat this first wife. What do you notice has to always be provided for equally? Food, clothing, and even conjugal rights. And some even go so far as even talk about in terms of inhabitation. You couldn't have them both living under the same roof, we would say. You couldn't, for them, they didn't share a tent. They had to have their own place. Each wife had to be taken care of. Food, clothing, shelter, and even in an intimate fashion. Then, notice verse 11. If he will not do these things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. He says, if there's not equality within this, what is she free to do? She's free to leave. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about old covenant things here, so don't try and tie this to the new. But you get an idea here. Even though here's polygamy, multiple wives of going, yet there's still law about this. Now, as you stop and think about this, you can't show favoritism. There can't be partiality. Now, take a look at another aspect of this. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 21, also under the old covenant. Deuteronomy chapter 21, look at verse 15. If a man has two wives, so under the old covenant, could you have multiple wives? You could. If a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, what a situation. Are we moving in the right direction yet? No. He says, the one loved, the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him sons. If the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then it shall be in the day he wills what he has to his sons. He cannot make the son of the loved the firstborn before the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. In other words, he can't go, and he's going to go on here in just a second to talk about, well, let's just go ahead and read verse 17. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the beginning of his strength, to him belongs the right of the firstborn. So, the firstborn, as we've already talked about in the past, gets a double portion. However, if the first son is not the son of the beloved wife, he can't just say, I want to switch this around. He doesn't have that right under the law. Now, you may be reading through these things and going, you know, Carrie, we've been reading some stories back here in Genesis that don't follow these laws. You're right. And guess why? These laws hadn't been established yet. We're reading about things in Genesis before the law is given on Mount Sinai to Moses by God. So, you see some of these principles at hand and we're going, boy, this is different. Now you start to see, why did God give these laws? How dysfunctional is the family back in Genesis? Very. So you understand, okay, there's not going to be another Jacob and Esau switching of the blessing. There's not going to be Leah and Rachel loved and unloved situation, according to law, to be okay. You start to also notice, we're not going to turn over and read it, but in Deuteronomy chapter 17, there's a law that's given to the kings, the future kings. Ironically, it's written over 500 years before King Saul will ever come around to be king over Israel. And one of the aspects that's within that is, as king, they can't multiply horses, they can't get them from Egypt, they can't multiply gold and silver, that wasn't the point. But specifically it says in verse 17, this is Deuteronomy 17, 17, he shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. And you realize, what happened to Saul? What happened to his heart? Turned away. What happened to David? His heart turned away. What happened to Solomon? His heart turned away. All of them had multiple wives, didn't they? Just the way God said it would happen, it happened. Now, here's another aspect of this. Who is sitting on the throne of David now? Jesus. How many wives does he have? One. And that's the church. And that tells you, he's going to be faithful to the one. And that was the law for the king, even way back under the old covenant. And you see him fulfill that to the highest. Now, you see all these things together. I want you now to look back at Genesis 29. Genesis 29. Look at verse 30. And welcome to labor and delivery. Get ready. Genesis 29, verse 30. So Jacob went into Rachel also, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban for another 7 years. Now, if you're counting the time about Jacob, 7 years he serves Laban, and the outcome is he gets Leah as a wife, even though that's not who he bargained for. Another 7 years with Rachel, and he's going to marry her early, but still serve those 7 years to keep his word. And then after that, later on, we're going to find out there's going to be 6 years that he works for Laban just for wages. So his time down up in Haran is going to be 20 years total in the end. So you see what's going on already. He loves Rachel more than Leah. And you go, I want you to see, just as part of what we're about to unfold a little bit more, what's the outcome of partiality and favoritism? Does it ever turn out something really beneficial for the whole? No. Can we learn that to where we appreciate it, to have understanding, to go, you know what? I'm not going to be someone who's partial. I'm not going to be someone who shows favoritism, because it only breeds this chaos. Now, is God going to be able to use these people? Yes, because who did he make a promise to? Abraham. And then to Isaac, and now to Jacob. God can use flawed people. Aren't we thankful? Now, notice how it continues. Verse 31. Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. I want you to realize, is God aware when there's partiality? Yes. Does he respond because of her being unloved? And in what way does he respond? Opens her womb. She's going to be given the ability to have a child or children. And then notice the flip side. What's going to happen with Rachel here? Barren. Barren for now. Then verse 32. He says, Leah conceived and bore a son and named him Reuben. For she said, because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me. What does this tell you about how Leah was feeling as part of this marriage relationship? She knew that she was unloved. It wasn't just something that was hidden. She is very well aware. And you may have footnotes for some of these names that are given and their meanings. Reuben is about what? Anybody got any footnotes? Anybody got something along the lines of, behold a son. Look at what God has done. He's given me a son. And if you notice what's written here, it says, because the Lord has seen my affliction. And Reuben is about what is seen. In other words, God is watching what I am going through. He has seen me, and what has he allowed to happen? I was allowed to have the firstborn son. Now, he says, Lord has seen my affliction. Surely now my husband will love me. Now that I have a son to give to Jacob, now he will love me. Is that really going to be the case? No, but it's high hopes. Now, notice how it continues on. Look at our next verse, verse 33. Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also. So she named him Simeon. And Simeon literally is about he who hears. Reuben, God has seen what I'm going through. Now, with Simeon, God hears. He hears me. He's attentive to me. And you think, in the middle of any kind of situation, isn't this what you want to have, to know? Not only does God see me, he hears me. He knows what I'm going through. I am being slighted. I am being unloved. Let's make this application something a little bit more broad, since we're not dealing with multiple wives under the new covenant. If you've ever wondered, whenever you're being treated in a way that is in terms of something that is partiality, something that is favoritism, and you're the one who's on the disadvantaged side of that, can you find comfort in realizing that God sees it and he hears it and that he knows? Now, so often we want to think, how come God doesn't do something? And you realize, look at what's going on with Leah. She's able to have sons, two so far. And yet, how is Rachel at this point? Still barren. Then, notice how it continues. The Lord, the covenant God, has heard that I am unloved. Verse 34. She conceived again and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons. Therefore, he was named Levi. And Levi means joined or joiner. And once again, notice how she's feeling about this relationship. I have a third son now that I get to share together with Jacob. What is she thinking this third son will do for their relationship? Oh, this will join us together. This will knit us together. Does it do that? No. I think about how many times in troubled marriages nowadays, people decide, you know what, our marriage isn't going so well. Maybe if we had a child, then it would change what's going on. Now, what's the reality of that? It doesn't, does it? But you realize that is not something that's a brand new thought. It's been around for a long time. And so, you get this picture here, and she says, three sons, and the idea about attached or joined is where Levi, that's that name. Now, think about later on, the descendants of Levi are going to hold what role in Israel? Priests. And if you remember the story about as to why, it's because they have allegiance, they're attached to God. They'll actually stand up and do what he desires, not just what they or somebody else wants to do. So that's how that comes together. Now, we also know not every Levite was a perfect image of what God desired. But just see that as a name in Levi. Verse 35. Yes. He still loved Rachel more, that's for sure. And understand, whenever you have multiple wives, there's an intimate side for every wife, so nobody gets excluded. Then notice verse 35. She conceived again and bore a son and said, "This time I will praise the Lord." Therefore she named him Judah. Then she stopped bearing. So now she has a fourth son and names him Judah. And of course, Judah is about praise to God. And here's what's kind of unique. Now she finally gets to this point. It's not about that I'll be attached to Jacob. Now it's about what? I'm going to praise God. Look at what God's done. Look at how he's interacted with me. And as her, and notice, this is kind of curious. As her attitude gets right, what happens next? She stops bearing. You finally come to the right conclusion. And stops for a little bit. Now keep in mind, go way back to Genesis. You remember what the penalty was for Eve whenever she sinned? Pain in childbearing. And you go, look at what's still going on in terms of these situations and having children. Chuck. Right. Right. Here's the right motive, and you see these things. Now, we're going to start moving pretty quick here. We got 24 more verses to try and cover. Look at verse 1 of chapter 30. Out of all these things together, you see what comes next in terms of what's happening. If you're keeping score at home, the idea is Leah has four children, Rachel has zero. And it's because of God's purpose. And understand this. The intimacy aspect of things is still going on. God has opened one womb and one is barren. Chapter 30 opens up. Let's see what Rachel's, what her attitude is about being loved or favored. Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister. And she said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." Now, notice what's going on. Even though she is the favored one, what's working inside of her? Jealousy. Jealousy is churning inside of her heart. And if you notice what she says, "Give me children or else I die." Ironically, that's a little foreshadowing. Because whenever she's going to have her second child, what's going to happen to her? She will die after she gives birth to Ben-Oni. "Son of my sorrow" is what she names him. Verse 2. Jacob hears this, and this is his beloved wife. And then there's unloved Leah. He says, then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel. Oh, I thought she was supposed to be the one that he loved. But now her attitude's pretty terrible, and now his goes to match with it. And he said, am I in the place of God? Who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? He says, am I in God's place? Yet, who had a part in this? Who is the husband who chose favoritism? Jacob did. Isn't that something? He gets angry because of his part that he played, not recognizing, I'm not in the place of God. Now, he's true, he's not in the place of God. But what is he doing? Is he reaping what he's sowing? You just see this principle over and over again, don't we? So, he says, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? And once again, here he comes, plans, plans, plans. You kind of wonder, had they heard the story about Hagar? Did Jacob remember his uncle Ishmael and what happened back there? Apparently not. Verse 3. She said, here is my maid, Bilhah. Go into her that she may bear on my knees, that through her I too may have children. He says, take her as a wife. Take my maid and take her as your wife, your third wife. Then, verse 4. So she gave him her maid, Bilhah, as a wife, and Jacob went into her. Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, God has vindicated me and has indeed heard my voice and has given me a son. Therefore she named him Dan. Do you notice who names the child? Rachel did. Isn't that something? Even though her maid, Bilhah, is given as a wife to Jacob, it's still Rachel that does the naming. Isn't that a little curious? Now, of course, Dan literally means to be judged. And so he knows, if I can have kind of this surrogate child in one sense, not literally, but you kind of understand this and go, look at what God is doing. What is God doing? Rachel still doesn't have a child. That's what God's doing. Now, and once again, you notice here about Dan meaning judge or judgment. Then, here we go again. Verse 7. Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. So Rachel said, with mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have indeed prevailed. And she named him Naphtali. Now, Naphtali means my wrestlings. And what is still going on? They're still just, I have prevailed. Prevailed. Now, make a little note of this. In Leviticus 18:18, under the old covenant, there was a law against what was going on in Genesis before that law existed. Leviticus 18:18 reads this way, and I think you'll understand it completely. You shall not marry a woman in addition to her sister as a rival while she is alive. What does God know? You do not need to marry sisters because they will be rivals. And if you notice the way it's worded in Leviticus 18:18, it says, as a rival while she is alive. Now, if the first sister dies, then you could marry the other sister, but not the two together. And once again, it's not as if God didn't know this in Genesis. But you see him giving these laws to protect people from themselves. Isn't that something? Oh, the wisdom of God. Now, so you come back over and you look at what he names him Naphtali. He says, mighty wrestle, I've wrestled with my sister and I've won. But what's interesting is Leah has four sons, but now Bilhah has two, and Rachel still has zero. Now, here we go again. Then come down to verse 9. When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she starts to notice, oh, now there's two more sons that have come that I didn't give birth to. She took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. All of a sudden, you see her go, well, let's just make up another plan. If I can't have any more children, then I'll just give you my maid. And now you see wife number four. And once again, understand, under the old covenant, that meant same food, same clothing, same rights in marriage, and to see those things together. Now, those things didn't exist back here in Genesis. But just notice what's at hand. Then, it says, Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son, verse 11. Then Leah said, how fortunate. So she named him Gad. And if you just wonder what Gad means, fortunate. It says, look at what's happened. Now I'm up 7-2. Now, it continues on, verse 12. Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, happy am I, for women will call me happy. So she named him Asher. Anybody know what Asher means? Any Asimovs back there know what the Asher means? Happiness. Look at there. What a great name for a son. And he is a pretty happy boy. So you start to notice, oh, look at how happy I am. Look at what's going on. And you go, all right, now you have six for Leah. You start to notice two on through Rachel with Bilhah. You see these things starting to rack up. Then we come to this next story. And this is quite a story in terms of what's here in that begins in verse 14 and goes through verse 18. And I think you'll understand. This is really the only name that gets a big explanation. All the other names kind of get a small one-phrase explanation about why they're called names. Now, here's a little side note, too. You may wonder why all the times I tell you what names mean. I hope you're starting to see that in the Old Testament, names really meant something. They weren't just something randomly plucked out. They usually had to do with the situation at time or an event that's taking place or something even along those lines. So it's always worth kind of paying attention to. Verse 14. Now, realize I mean, Reuben's going to be old enough to where he's working in the harvest. So understand where we are here in verse 14, that there's eight sons that have already been born, and time is going by. Verse 14. Now, in the days of wheat harvest, and the wheat harvest in Palestine's in May, just to kind of give you a setting, he says, Reuben went and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Now, whenever I was young, I used to think mandrakes were just, well, we're just talking about male ducks, right? Mandrakes, right? I was young, naive, and dumb. I had a lot of things going for me. So notice what's here, and then let's deal with it at the end of verse 14 first. Then Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. Now, mandrakes are literally a hallucinogenic, a narcotic, an aphrodisiac. They have the consistency of like a potato, but they have a really, really aromatic. Solomon even writes about them in Song of Solomon, about how pleasing. He says the mandrakes have given forth fragrance in kind of his love letter there. And so you look at all these things together, and so there's even some like mythological things of old about fertility. That's not scriptural things. That's just kind of cultural things. But here they are. It was a root. It was not edible. If you ate it, it was poisonous. But what's laid out here says, oh, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. As if, oh, share those with me. Now, you know they get along really good, don't they? Would you share those with me? Your son Reuben found them. Firstborn. Verse 15. But she said to her, is it a small matter for you to take my husband? Well, you can tell what's just on the foremind of her thought, can't you? He says, is it just small to you to take my husband? And would you take my son's mandrakes also? He says, are you going to take those things for yourself? Yo, oh boy, she really likes this. He says, and would you take my son's mandrakes also? So Rachel said, therefore, he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes. Boy, you talk about one crazy family. It's like, I have conjugal rights tonight. If you'll give me those mandrakes, then you can surprise him just like you did on your wedding night. Except for it's not going to be a surprise because it's going to be told to Jacob what's going on. What a fun role to play as a husband of four wives. Verse 16, when Jacob came in from the field in the evening, then Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. I tell you, is this not crazy? But here's what it is. And notice, he says, so he lay with her that night. Then verse 17, God gave heed to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. And remember, she had been barren for a while, but now here comes a fifth son. And in that time, she has to think of a name in between. What can we call this boy? Here we go. Verse 18. Then Leah said, God has given me my wages because I gave my maid to my husband. So she named him Issachar, which literally means wages. Because I paid, this is what we're going to call him. And you think about so many people in this world deal with such difficult names. Can you imagine going, oh, hello, my name's Wages. Why is your name Wages? Wouldn't you hate to tell that story? Now, you start to notice, all right, there's another son. Verse 19, Leah conceived again and bore a sixth son to Jacob. Then Leah said, God has endowed me with a good gift. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons. So she named him Zebulun. Now, when you think about Zebulun, it literally is about to exalt with honor. And notice what she's still pressing through. Now that I've given him six sons, surely he will honor me. Which tells you how unloved she really was. And tells you how sad of a story this really is. And you may be thinking about this. It says she named him Zebulun. In the New Testament, in Matthew chapter 4, Jesus is going to move from living in Nazareth to living in Capernaum. And when it talks about it in Matthew chapter 4, it shows you a quotation from Isaiah chapter 9, talking about there's one who is coming, and he will live in the land of, make sure I say this right, Zebulun and Naphtali. When you think about Zebulun meaning a place of honor and Naphtali, a wrestling match, you go, here's what Jesus is wrestling with. He's going to be this great light to all the Gentiles and to everyone. And this is what he's going to do. And so you understand, later on, a land that's going to be inherited, going to be named after two brothers, and that's kind of part of it as well. Verse 21, afterwards she bore a daughter and named her Dinah. Wow. Can you imagine? Here we are after all these verses, and you have ten sons and a daughter. Now, Dinah is an interesting name, too. It's the feminine version of Dan. So it really means a judgment together. Maybe in the same way that you think about English names of, you know, if the masculine is Paul and the feminine is Paula. You know, if you got Max and the female would be Maxine. You know, same kind of thing here. Victor, Victoria, however far you want to go with that. A very similar idea in going, look at the justice of God. I get to have a daughter. Now, here's Dinah. Then, verse 22. Then God remembered Rachel. And God gave heed to her and opened her womb. Now, here's already been 11 children that have been born. 10 sons, one daughter. Leah's had 6 sons and a daughter. Bilhah, 2 sons. Zilpah, 2 sons. And here's Rachel. The favored. Isn't it something how the one who is favored in the beginning doesn't seem to turn out well in the end? It's amazing how that goes. Something else I want to kind of point out about this. All the favoritism back and forth between Leah and Rachel. Jacob should have changed his mind. He should have shown some equality, some equity among his wives. Rachel, too, being favored, had an opportunity. Say, Jacob, you should treat Leah better. You should treat her well. Do you ever find yourself being someone who is favored in a situation where other people are being looked down upon? Make sure you use it in a way that's beneficial to everyone. You may find yourself now no longer being the favored one. But you realize you're standing up for what's just. And so often people are favored, they just enjoy it, as opposed to using it for a really righteous purpose. Now, you understand here, is God really working things together according to his will? Yes. He can use people, even in their wrong desires, to do what he desires for an overall good and keeping his promises. But notice this, verse 23. So she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. And when you think about this idea about taking away my reproach, it's about in the name Joseph in verse 24. It says, she named him Joseph saying, may the Lord give me another son. She finally has a first son. And what does she want? Give me one more. And ironically, how many more is she going to have? One more, and then what's going to happen? She'll die. Now, the favored one who says, give me children or give me death. I'll give you both. Be careful what you ask for. Now, Joseph is really about increaser or may he add. So you kind of understand how that fits together with the situation. She wants another. If you do the math backwards from parts of Genesis that we haven't read yet, at this point in time, whenever Joseph is born, Jacob is 91 years old. Now, realize, he's only been married about 14 years. You'll see in the very next section, as we follow up, continuing on next week, of going, you're going to see that's whenever this 6 years begins that he works for Laban. So he's 91 years old, and for the last 14 years, he's had at least 12 children. Now, later on in the book of Genesis, well, let's just look at it real quick before the bell rings. Genesis 46. Genesis 46, verse 7. Dinah is the only daughter that we know of by name, but I want to show you that there were other daughters. Genesis 46, and look at verses 6 and 7. They took their livestock and their property, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and came to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him. Notice, all of Jacob's descendants are coming back with Jacob to the land of Canaan. Verse 7, his sons, plural, no problem there, and his grandsons with him, so now there's a second generation, his daughters, plural, catch that, not just Dinah, doesn't say, and a daughter, it says daughters, plural. So realize there's at least one other daughter in there somewhere that's not mentioned in what we've read. He says, and his granddaughters and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. And you go, I just want you to notice, and that's not the only place in Genesis that it brings up about Jacob having daughters, plural. I just want you to just notice that. Just make a note in your mind. And so you realize, here they are, all this family. And you think, even at this point, we know Benjamin hasn't been born yet. But to go, here's 12 that are mentioned by name, 11 sons, one daughter. And yet, as a family, how are they working together? Not very well at all. I mean, like, how many times after a child's born, going, maybe this is the time whenever he'll love me? Which tells you she's not loved. And look at what she endures. And how did God bless her? I'll give you 6 sons and a daughter. I'll take care of you, even though you're not being seen out for by your husband. That's an amazing thing to think of. If you're married to a guy who's not very, very obedient to the word, will God still pay attention to you? Is he attentive to you? And to know that you will be taken care of. And so the blessings that are there. All right. I know we covered a lot tonight. I'm sorry about that, but it just kind of get to the delivery ward and go on. All right. Have a good week.